It's WrestlePod, the Troopany Show, with your host, James Troopany.
Hello, and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany, and this is my show. Once again, we return to the Beginner's Guide to Japanese Wrestling, Part 5, I understand. And today we are looking at Tatsumi Fujinami and Riki Choshu, part of the first generation of New Japan Pro Wrestling. Two very interesting characters who really set the tone for the company in the 1980s and into the 1990s. And to join me to discuss that today is Miss Chelsea Spollen of ShouldersUp.net. How are you, Chelsea?
I'm doing pretty well.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. We will go for a short break and then we will return with talk of Fujinami and Choshu.
WrestlePlus.com is the brand new home of incredible online wrestling content, featuring uncensored shoot interview classics, full series of WrestleTalk TV and British Wrestling Weekly, exclusive documentaries, British wrestling's biggest names before they were stars, an incredible podcast collection, up to 90% off merchandise offers, and the brand new Power Slammed e-magazine forwarded by Finn Martin himself. WrestlePlus has thousands of hours of content with new and exclusive releases added regularly. You can join today for the stupidly low price of just £4.99 a month. Wrestle Plus, because this is wrestling.
Welcome back. I'm guessing, Chelsea, you'd not seen a lot of Riki Choshu and Tatsumi Fujinami before I said, do you want to do this podcast?
I really hadn't. I was actually surprised at how easy it was to find matches that everybody, like, a lot of times when you go looking for matches from this period, you find something on YouTube or Daily Motion that has, like, no comments on it, and everybody has lots to say about these two.
Yeah, they were two very political animals, and they were also two incredibly good wrestlers, and they were the two biggest draws outside of Antonio Inoki. Now, this period of New Japan Pro Wrestling, there's a lot of unrest, as we will discuss a little bit of that unrest today, but there was other unrest as well. These two were not the only members of the first generation, and probably the other most notable member of the first generation was Akira Maeda, and it may sound a little harsh that we're leaving him out today, but I want to give Akira Maeda his due and give him a whole episode, because what he did with pro wrestling was something very special indeed, and we're still seeing repercussions of it, not only in pro wrestling, but also in mixed martial arts today. So today we're going to concentrate on Fujinami and Choshu. We'll start with Fujinami. Because he's the elder of the two. He was a young wrestler who started in the JWA. He's one of the New Japan originals. He's one of the founders of New Japan Pro Wrestling. He was an Antonio Inoki... what's the phrase there?
Protégé.
Protégé, yes. He was Antonio Inoki protégé. He was trained by Carl Gotch as well. And he had a long and active career from 1971, really until the present day. He hasn't really stopped wrestling. He's still involved in the wrestling industry. And he was... a rookie in New Japan, and was treated as such. He competed in the 1974 Carl Gotch Cup. He was a junior heavyweight, really, by trade in his early days, and he was the one that brought the WWF Junior Heavyweight Championship to New Japan Pro Wrestling in 1978, which was really important to the development of the junior heavyweight division. In fact, there wasn't really a junior heavyweight division before him. What's your thoughts on Fujinami, Chelsea, in this, coming at it to completely fresh eyes? Because I've been watching the guy for 20 years now. So what do you think of him, as, and what's your impressions of him?
So first of all, I was pretty astonished, actually, to think of the fact that he started his wrestling career at like 14 or something like that. Completely ridiculous. And then I think New Japan Pro was founded when he was like 16. He struck me as somebody, from everything I read about him, who was sort of handicapped by like the glass ceiling that was Inoki being like the most over, most popular guy for a really long time. It took him a long time, I think, for people to appreciate him. But watching him work is really interesting. He's... I don't know how to explain it. I think of a lot of the New Japan Pro Wrestling that I've seen from the modern era as being, you know, like... I guess the phrase that Smarks use on the internet is like spot heavy, right? Like there's a lot of really, really slick, really, really elegant, flashy, athletic stuff. And watching stuff from this time period, I think you can still tell that there's like more of an emphasis on pure wrestling. I think Fujinami, you can see that in his wrestling. But I think Fujinami is probably one of the smoother guys from the like still like grappling heavy style. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I kind of compare him. The first time I saw him really seriously was in the early 90s. And there was a lot of comparison between him and Ric Flair, which we'll get to in time, because obviously we're not at the early 90s yet. We're still in the mid-1970s.
I can see that.
Yeah, and when I first saw him, I kind of saw him as a Japanese equivalent of Flair or Nick Bockwinkel, those super smooth wrestlers that had been trained in shoot style and had these beautiful transitions from move to move.
Yeah.
You know, the Kurt Hennig-style wrestlers. You know, the old school workhorses of the AWA and the NWA, those kind of guys. And he really kind of paralleled with those guys for me. He was a guy that was very much about the beauty of what he was trying to do. And it, you know, he wrestled some tough characters. And then there was some plenty of stiffness going on with what he was doing. But it was all about ring skill for me with him. That's my initial impression of him when I first saw him. Obviously, he was a lot older then, but and he had a lot more experience to make that style work really, really well. But clearly, he had to be successful to be in the Japanese consciousness for that length of time.
Right. I mean, I watched a match between him. I mean, I watched a few of his matches, but I watched a match between him and Vader. And
a classic.
That was really interesting.
Yeah.
Vader sort of plays that like big, lumbering, like, I mean, Vader's not lumbering himself, like, you know, he had a lot of athletic skill, but like in that match he sort of lets the like big swagger elements of his style take over, and Fujinami has like the more, I want to say, almost like balletic technical approach. It's really interesting.
Yeah definitely. It was a clash of styles, but it works so well. You know,
yeah.
And that was the big feud of the 90s that really set up the New Japan kind of company as it moved into the second generation. But going back to the 1970s, he spends a lot of time in the Universal Wrestling Association in Mexico, which was a notable promotion because it didn't just rely on Mexican wrestlers. It invited a lot of North American and Japanese wrestlers to come and work in the company. In fact, funnily enough, Vader was a champion of the UWA many years later. He also wrestles for Jim Crockett Promotions in the late 1970s. And I'm presuming there's probably some George Scott influence, because Jim Crockett Promotions was being booked by George Scott. And then he moved to the World Wide Wrestling Federation in the early 1980s. And funnily enough, so did Fujinami. And like I said, he wins the WWF Junior Heavyweight Championship on January 23rd, 1978, brings it back to Japan and establishes it as the junior heavyweight title in the world. And I think that's really interesting as to how that all works out for junior heavyweights in New Japan. He's the guy that really set the standard and kind of set the path for what junior heavyweight wrestling would be.
So I have a question about the WWF Junior Heavyweight Championship, actually.
Okay.
Because I was trying to follow the title chronology a little bit. And I know that it sort of eventually became like the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship. Like they sort of transitioned from what they were using the WWF Junior Heavyweight Championship as to the IWGP Junior Heavyweight. Did WWF do anything to replace that title?
Not necessarily. There was the WWF Light Heavyweight Championship, which appeared during the Attitude, just early days of the Attitude era, when the cruiserweights in WCW were really, you know, pulling in big numbers and were critically acclaimed, and it was another spoke on the wheel of the Monday Nitro machine.
And that's the one that X-Pac had for a while, right?
Yeah, yeah. And what happened in WWE was, well, or WWF as it was at the time, they were like, well, we've got to kind of cash in on this, and then completely did it entirely wrong. The WWF light heavyweight title was actually in Mexico, I think, and it ended up being part of the Unified Championship. There was a tournament in 93 or 94 that Jushin Liger organized and was won by Ultimo Dragon, and it was part of that J Crown Championship. There you go. It was part of the J Crown Championship, and then WWF went, we won it back, because it was, I think, I can't remember, one of the Mexican promotions who were never that particularly stable when it comes to like giving things back. They had it, and it was ended up being part of this championship, and they were like, all right then. So it was no longer the J Crown after that. And that's where the the light heavyweight division in New Japan, in WWF, started, but they did it with very traditional ground-based, kind of like small versions of the heavyweights. And,
right.
And so they never, it never really got off the ground until the most fun they had with it was when Goldberg won the title in his Goldberg send-up.
the less said about that, the better.
Yes, which ended when Goldberg got signed by WWE. And just as a little side note and a point there, there was rumors that it was going to be a Goldberg versus Goldberg match, but Vince McMahon vetoed it on the grounds he didn't want the little guy getting killed.
The things that Vince chooses to care about are sometimes very interesting.
Yeah. Wow, you're actually caring about a worker there. Good. Well, fair enough. But yes, so getting back to where we are with the New Japan WWF Junior Heavyweight Championship, which becomes the WWF Junior Heavyweight Championship, which becomes a cornerstone of the New Japan style. I'm glad when we get out the 70s and we can stop using the three W's. they became the cornerstone of the New Japan style, and the next major important feud was obviously Tiger Mask and the Dynamite Kid. But we'll talk about them in a separate episode as well, because I think we need an hour to talk about
yes.
Tiger Mask and the Dynamite Kid. So we'll talk about that separately. But he essentially set up the junior heavyweight kind of style and the division. And it was kind of a smaller man's heavyweight kind of style, though it was very fluid and very scientifically technical, like we expect it to be. It wasn't as high spot heavy because guys hadn't really thought of that stuff yet, and it was much more mat grounded based. Meanwhile, Riki Chosu, he was making his way in the promotion. In 1972, he wrestled for South Korea in the Olympics. He didn't place in the tournament, but he did go on to be a pro wrestler. He debuted for New Japan in 1974, and he went to North America to gain experience too. And when he came back, he was a big star for Antonio Inoki. And Riki Chosu is an interesting character because of his South Korean heritage. You know, there was always a thing with Inoki about revering his master in Riki Dozan, who, of course, was a Korean Japanese. And in the same way that Riki Chosu was a Korean Japanese, I think possibly Inoki kind of saw him as a bit of a pet project.
It's interesting because it's hard to tell at a distance, or at least it was for me, much about their relationship, because when they talk about each other, they don't say very much.
No.
They sort of go out of their way not to comment on their interpersonal relationship. But yeah, I could kind of see that. He wasn't like a protege, right? Like more like a peer, but not quite treated like he was on Inoki's level.
Yeah, I mean, he was trained by Master Saito, and Master Saito came from the JWA. And, you know, Master Saito is probably one of the biggest Japanese names to make it in North America because of his long-time association with the AWA. But he was a kind of different style of wrestler, even though he's kind of, you know, he's shorter than Fujinami, but he's heavier than Fujinami. He's kind of a fireplug kind of style wrestler. That amateur background really stood him well. And though he's an amateur wrestler, he isn't really a scientific wrestler in that sense.
Mm.
He's a powerhouse wrestler for a guy who's 260 pounds. I suppose the most equal kind of comparison to today's wrestler is Tomohiro Ishii, that, you know, former junior heavyweight.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, I see that right away.
Yeah, he's that kind of guy. He's kind of fireplug kind of sized, always fighting from underneath. And that made him a massive star in New Japan because he was obviously the underdog at that point when you're looking at it from that point of view.
It's interesting that the guy, I'm thinking about that, it's interesting to think of a guy like that he invented the sharpshooter.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the guy that invented the sharpshooter as well. Long before Bret Hart and Sting and The Rock, the sharpshooter was invented by Riki Chosu, the Scorpion Deathlock, as it was originally named by Riki Chosu. And he probably still is the guy who did it best, I think.
Yeah, it was in one of the matches that I watched, and I wasn't expecting it, so but I was like, oh my god, that's so cool. And yeah, I think probably because it's a move that now, you know, I see it on television sometimes like 2-3 times a week, and watching it in some of those matches, maybe just because it seemed like the crowd wasn't expecting it, everybody got really excited when it happened.
Yeah.
So that was kind of neat.
I think as a true finisher as well, you know, it's it's lost its kind of zing as a finisher, because obviously The Rock didn't use it as a finisher. It was a transition submission hold for him, and that kind of takes the edge off of it.
Natalya tries to use it as a finisher, but she's not allowed to win matches anymore, so
yeah, so it's not really as much use as it could be for anybody else. Jigasuyu Nagayo used to do it in All Japan as well, but it was kind of a transition, because no one really won matches through submission in All Japan women.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had to hit people really, really hard.
I was going to say, they weren't that kind.
No. So he was innovative in a different way, but probably the most innovative thing he did was being the first traitor heel in Japan. He was a guy who turned his back on New Japan Pro Wrestling and formed Ishin-Gun, the Revolutionary Army, when he wasn't picked for the first IWGP Heavyweight Tournament in 1983, which was eventually won by Hulk Hogan. And that was the break-off point for Ishin-Gun to actually end up making their own company, Japan Pro Wrestling. And then they went on to invade All Japan Pro Wrestling and have the most successful at the time invasion angle, which me and Alex Edwards discussed in the last episode at the end of the IWE days. They, a couple of years before, did an invasion of New Japan and All Japan because they were just looking for work. And this was actually an invasion of All Japan from a separate company, which was JPW, of New Japan Pro Wrestlers, which is interesting, to say the least. And it became the foundation for all other invasion angles ever since then. There's been lots of them, as me and Alex discussed. And I found that really interesting. He was the first guy to be, like, one of the first guys to change style in his career. Because usually it was a cradle-to-grave thing. You were a face, you were a heel, and that was it. There was no in-between.
I never thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of guys evolved into being faces or evolved into being heels, but it wasn't like they specifically went out to do that. It's just the way it happened. But he was the guy...
turned on Fujinami when he turned, right?
Yeah, and so it's like, you know, there's always been this thing with those two. And if you look at it through New Japan's history since Inoki, there's been two guys at the top, or two or three guys at the top. In the second generation, it ends up being Chono and Hashimoto and Muto. And then in the third generation, there's Nagata and Tenzan and Kojima. But Kojima goes off to All Japan, so it's really Nagata and Tenzan. And then in the fourth generation, it's Nakamura and Tanahashi. And now in this fifth generation, essentially it's Naito and Okada. You've always got two people pushing each other forward. And there is maybe tension between them that is storyline tension. And in this case, between Chosu and Fujinami, it was definitely real tension. And Chosu definitely felt undervalued compared to Fujinami. And that's the reason why he left the company. Though, having said that, and what put an interesting thing spin on this story was from last year, there was a shoot interview. I'm sure it was Chono and Muto. And they were discussing various things from New Japan's past. And they said this was an entirely a work. And that kind of blew my mind.
They said that the feud between the two of them was entirely a work?
No, the Ishin-Gun leaving New Japan, forming their own company, and joining All Japan was entirely a work.
Wow.
And I'm like, what? Why would you
How is that possible?
Yeah, I'm like, how? Well, I think originally the idea was they set them up as a separate company to do an invasion into New Japan.
Right.
But they got that successful. They went to All Japan instead because they offered more money. And I'm like, I'm not sure how true this is, but that is one of those interesting backstage stories you don't hear about till 20 years later that just made my mind go, whoomp. Because it's like, that. If that's true, that's incredible. So, yeah. So All Japan took hold of Ishin-Gun, which was, the Japan Pro Wrestling organization, which had a hell of a lineup. Animal Hamaguchi, Yoshiaki Yatsu, Masa Saito, Koniaki Kobayashi, and Izumi Terunashi. These guys were really, really good. These guys were the top of the crop of New Japan Pro Wrestling, especially Animal Hamaguchi, who's gone on to train no end of people, and Masa Saito, who was probably the second biggest draw behind Inoki. They were really important to New Japan's development, and Chosu took them to All Japan Pro Wrestling and made money with Baba, which is, you know, the kind of like the cornerstone of All Japan Pro Wrestling getting good in the 1980s. So he didn't just have an influence on on New Japan Pro Wrestling. He also had an influence on All Japan Pro Wrestling as well.
It's kind of interesting how, for lack of a better word, incestuous all of that stuff is. Like, one promotion seems to bleed into the other, really.
Yeah, but they, but on the surface, they seem so apart. Like, the style-wise, they're just completely different. Yeah. And Baba and Inoki don't really talk that much. And occasionally, they'll cross-promote things begrudgingly because they know it's good for the industry, but they know it's good for business, but they don't really want to. They want to do their own thing. Yeah, however...
They want to be separate totems.
Yeah, however, you know... And, you know, Baba... There was a big period in this time where Baba was signing people straight away from New Japan Pro Wrestling, like Stan Hansen, Abdullah the Butcher. Well, Abdullah the Butcher went the other way. He went to New Japan, and Inoki was trying to steal talent from All Japan, and All Japan was trying to steal talent from New Japan. And eventually, they called a truce. They said, no, we're not doing this anymore, because otherwise it's just costing us both a fortune, and why are we doing that? You know, that doesn't make any sense. So, you know, it did push the value of wrestlers well up in Japan at the time. And you know, because they were trying that much harder to get noticed, it pushed the quality forward. And, you know, Fujinami and Chosu were two of those guys that really pushed that boundary to make things better for the wrestlers.
Wow.
So there you go. Eventually, though, Ishin-Gun did reinvade New Japan Pro Wrestling. and they came back in 1987, just around the time of New Japan's partnership with the American Wrestling Association. And, you know, Fujinami and Chosu back in the same promotion again in the late 80s, where things started to get really interesting around the IWGP Heavyweight Championship. At that point, Inoki is kind of fading away from being the top draw. And now you've really got a chance for these two to shine. And it's impossible to say kind of like how dominant Inoki was over the rest of the New Japan roster.
He was the guy.
Yeah, he was the guy, the guy, the guy. In much the same way as Hogan was in WWE in the 80s and Steve Austin was in WWE in the late 90s, but even more so because he was such a touchstone cultural icon and he had the links back to Ricky Dozan and the JWA. And yeah, it's fascinating really when you think about it, that the level of influence he had, but it did mean that Ricky Chosu and Fujinami couldn't really get anywhere, could they?
Yeah, the Inoki shaped glass ceiling was a thing I read a lot about.
Yeah. And you know, Fujinami was the loyal one. He was a devout loyalist of Inoki, and come hell or high water, he wouldn't go anywhere. Whereas Chosu, It was a mark of his career that he was a bit of a rebel. Not just inside the ring in storylines, he wanted to do things differently. And I think possibly because he was that one step away from Inoki because he'd been trained by Saito, whereas Fujinami had been trained by Inoki and Gotch.
I think also he was othered, you know, by being Korean too. Like it's hard to say exactly how much of an effect that had, but from the outside, I have no trouble believing when he said that he faced some discrimination because of that. I think it was probably likely that even when he wanted to fit in with everybody else, he still felt set apart all the time.
Yeah, we should probably explain that a little bit. The relationship between Korea and Japan has never been nice.
It's antagonistic, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, it's reasonable now. It's the close. Then we're talking about South Korea. Japan and North Korea is a whole other different story. And this isn't a history lesson. This is a wrestling history lesson. But unless we put the social history context in place, then you won't understand the difficulties Riki Chosu had as a Korean wrestler in Japan. And the relationship since the Second World War, there's a lot of things to forgive, and it's taken a very long time, and those things haven't necessarily been forgiven, or if they have, they definitely haven't been forgotten.
I mean, I think it's also like to the extent that if you're Korean and you live in Japan, even if you have lived there your whole life, if you have Korean citizenship, I don't think you're allowed to vote. There's certain kinds of property you can't legally own. Like, it's still... You still don't have full access to the things that native-born Japanese people do.
Yeah, and, you know, Geijin still don't necessarily have... even Western Geijins are probably better received than Korean Geijin, I would guess, really, because of the the area of which they are in. You know, this is a very complex story, and me and Chelsea probably can't give you the whole thing. You should go and read about it if you're more interested in that. But we have to put a little bit of context in there. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense, because this guy is a phenomenal draw. He's charismatic. He can wrestle. His style is very different to Fujinami's, that fireplug style. He's an underdog. And then he comes in as a heel and is a truly aggressive heel. And he's a very different animal to Fujinami in that sense. And that separation, like we said, that separation from being as an outsider in Japan in the society and as an outsider within the wrestling community really fires up what he's doing in the ring and the stories he's trying to tell, I think.
I mean, I think you can see it, you know. I think a contrast I noticed between the two of them, because I watched a match that they had against each other, is that Fujinami is somebody that you notice because of the way he moves, and Riki Choshu is somebody that you notice because of the natural, like, magnetism that he has, the presence that he has. He just kind of carries it with him all the time.
Yeah, that's it. You know, he's the guy that's you just look at him and he looks like a badass. You know, Fujinami in a suit looks Fujinami in a suit looks like a used car salesman in the nicest possible sense. He does.
That's totally true.
He's just like, he's a nice chap. You'd want to go and have a nice cup of coffee and discuss business dealings with him. Whereas Chosu looks like he's going to be in a bar playing pool and you're going to walk in and he's just going to stare at you and you'll want to leave.
I think that's why Fujinami is the one with the Legends deal with WWE,
yeah,
who helps them sign Japanese stars, and Choshu isn't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Now, Fujinami, kind of in the late 80s, certainly hits his stride. He has more learning excursions in different places. He goes to the NWA, Pacific Northwest, which is the old NWA territory. Quite a long run of excursions in the 1980s. And then he gets back to New Japan, and he's the big draw. Now Inoki is retired. He's brought down. Not retired, but he's semi-retired. He's trying to give those second-level players a chance to make it to the top of the tree. And you've got Big Van Vader, who's the big Gaijin heel at the time. And there's that feud with Vader and Fujinami, which really sets the tone for the 1990s. It's so stiff. The match quality is so high. Vader is really singing on all cylinders as the monster heel. And you saw this match, or one of these matches. What did you think of it?
It's really dramatic and really intense. I was expecting a match where they were just going to hit each other, and it's actually much more technical than that, but it doesn't lose any of its emotional intensity throughout. Like, there's a good like slow build there going towards sort of like a crescendo towards the finish. They're both really good dramatic storytellers. I mean, I know that's not what people talk about Vader for, and I don't know if that was something that he like stepped up his game with because of Choshu, but they seem to have a really good chemistry. It was really interesting.
Yeah, those matches always seem to be like Fujinami, when he was on the losing end, would always put in a valiant effort, and when he came back, he looked so dominant, you know. And it's really kind of,
yeah,
a strange look of a guy who's giving away 200 pounds and a lot of height to this other wrestler, and but he looks dominant. He looks like he can't be beat, and he takes the championship back. And it's very believable as well. It's such a believable storytelling device, and it's so well done. I was really impressed with Fujinami in this era, and this was where I really started to see him as the great wrestler that he was during this period.
I feel like I don't want to just talk about moves, but I also thought it was really interesting that he innovated the dragon sleeper and the dragon suplex, because I think of those, like, I was thinking of a dragon suplex. That's such a Japanese move. Like, so many of the Japanese modern stars now use that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought that was interesting. I didn't realize that came from him from this time period.
Yeah, this is where he starts to innovate and starts to bring in new maneuvers that a lot of people, like you said, have used ever since. And also, one of the first things he did that during this period, one of the things he did that no one else had done was go to WCW and be a draw for WCW as well, only for one pay-per-view, but still. And he was wrestling Ric Flair. And we now go into the convoluted story of the NWA and WCW World Championships of 1990, and to explain it slightly differently yet again, what happened was the WCW World Championship had been declared in 1990 as a separate title from the NWA World Heavyweight Championship because WCW was part of the NWA, were still paying dues to the company, and they were still using the NWA Championship. And then there was a co-promoted show in New Japan Pro Wrestling, which was the one of the first Tokyo Dome shows on January the 4th, in which Fujinami beats Flair for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. Now, there are two referees in that particular match, Bill Alfonso and Tiger Hattori. Tiger Hattori is a New Japan referee, and he doesn't disqualify Fujinami for tossing Ric Flair over the top rope, but Bill Alfonso does. So Tiger Hattori then counts the pinfall of Ric Flair that Fujinami makes on Ric Flair. So under WCW rules, Flair is still the WCW World Heavyweight Champion. Under NWA rules, which is the rules of the home promotion, Tatsumi Fujinami is the NWA World Heavyweight Champion.
That's a little complicated.
And he's already the IWGP Heavyweight Champion. They then went to Super Brawl in March, and Fujinami, in a really, really good match, because both matches were really, really good, because it's Fujinami at the absolute peak of his ability, and Flair arguably at the peak of his ability as well. Probably come down a little bit from the early 80s and the mid 80s, but he's certainly still going strong. And they had a phenomenal match, not just your average Flair wrestling match. It was really, really good. And Fujinami loses the championship, and everything's back to normal. And Flair is NWA and WCW World Champion, and Fujinami didn't put his IWGP title on the line, so therefore he's still IWGP Heavyweight Champion. I hope I cleared that up for everybody, because it's something that keeps coming back every few years. but yeah, so Fujinami is really rocking as like a main draw for New Japan in this time period. In 93, he goes on to win the G1 Climax tournament. And in 94, he wins his fifth IWGP Heavyweight Championship from Shinya Hashimoto. This five-year period is really probably his best period as a main draw for New Japan Pro Wrestling. And you've watched a lot of the matches, I guess, from that particular era. What are his impressions of Fujinami at that particular point?
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is like no signs of slowing down. he just gets better with age. I mean, he's still wrestling, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Yeah, he still does wrestle for quite a few people.
That's pretty amazing. It's interesting watching him as a top guy because he's just so over with the crowd in every match that I watched. And watching him sort of like past his peak, he's still, if anything, I would say maybe even like a little smoother than he was when he was like the super top guy. Yeah. He just keeps getting better, keeps pushing the envelope.
Meanwhile, over in the Chosu corner, he's going on a lot of excursions as well. He's going to the AWA because they had the talent swap agreement with New Japan before they went to WCW. And he starts feuding with Fujinami over the IWGP Championship, but never beats him, actually, in that particular
era. Didn't realize that,
yeah,
really?
He challenged him on May the 27th, 89, and then he lost. It was a no contest, the title was held up, and then Fujinami wins the rematch. So that's interesting. You know, there's never really a listed time when he wins the championship. I will just check, because I'm pretty sure he hasn't done. He did win the championship, but he didn't win it from Fujinami, which is an interesting story within itself. You know, just looking.
Is that something they did on purpose to keep that feud going? Like, sort of keep the idea of who's better unanswered?
Well, I mean, you can look at the shows from this particular time. So, Fujinami wins his first title in 88. It's vacated with the match against Chosu, and then he wins it back later in the year. He vacates it for the Battle Satellite tournament, which Big Van Vader wins, so he loses the championship. And he wins it back off of Ricky Chosu in 1990, then drops it to Vader, wins it back from Vader, drops it to Chosu. So he does get, there is one loss towards Chosu there in that whole time period, but it always seems like Chosu's chasing the championship all the time in this era. And he's the guy who's nearly there, not the guy who is there.
Right.
Which I think is, yeah, again, it kind of floats back to that Nakamura Tanahashi thing, doesn't it? There's the prototype for that relationship. And though Nakamura and Tanahashi get on a lot better than Chosu and Fujinami did, you know,
right.
The story of Nakamura and Tanahashi is what's driven New Japan Pro Wrestling for the last 11 years, really, up until Nakamura left in January.
It's really interesting how in this time period that we're talking about with the first generation, there's all this politics and all this backstabbing that's preventing these guys who are on the same level from having, you know, a close, good working relationship. And now a lot of that stuff, not that there isn't politics now, because there still is, definitely, for sure. But I think of so many of the New Japan Pro superstars. I think of so many of the New Japan Pro wrestlers as being, you know, having like a really close personal relationship backstage. Like there's a lot of camaraderie there.
Yeah, I think so as well. They trust each other a lot. And it's a lot. I think that possibly comes down to there was a lot more need to stick together to make the New Japan a bigger company again. You know, the period we're talking about with Chosu and Fujinami, it was the biggest company in the world. WWE didn't even get a lock in, you know, in this time period from 90 to 95. The big shows were in New Japan, you know, the big shows were in Japan in general. They were the ones that were really shifting units and making lots of money. WWF were too, don't get me wrong, but you know, certainly for that stretch from 93 to 95, New Japan was a bigger promotion than WWF was when it came to Live Gate. I think there was more at stake, so there was more pressure. Whereas you look at Nakamura and Tanahashi in the early 2000s, they're only getting 15,000 at the Tokyo Dome. It's kind of sad, and it's not good. So they had to band together to make this work, and there was a sense of loyalty to each other and loyalty to the company that I think pushed that boundary a lot more. You know, that there was a lot more camaraderie because they were all in the same boat, whereas Chosu and right. Fujinami were kind of like trying to fight for the direction of this multi-million dollar company.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, and if we look at the G1 climax as well, it's reflective of the pattern for these guys. I mean, Fujinami wins it in 1993, and then Chosu wins it in 1996. And if I remember correctly, he won that undefeated. He wins the Riki Chosu wins the World Cup tournament in 1989. And then, which is the predecessor to, or one of the predecessors to the G1 climax. Fujinami then wins it in 1993, and then Chosu wins it in 96. And I think he won all the matches in that year. He just swept the tournament.
Yeah, he did every single match in the tournament.
Yeah, which is just unheard of. You know, that's an incredible push, especially for a guy who in 1996 was, how old was he in 96? Let's see. In 96, he was 45. That's a lot of faith in your, you know, in this guy. And it was kind of like his last swing at New Japan greatness. And he kind of moved into a booking position after that. But again, it's one hell of a kind of legacy to have this guy go through, the only guy, no one's done it since, to beat everybody in the tournament.
I sort of feel like if you did it now, it wouldn't work.
Yeah, it's not realistic enough, is it? You know. I mean, I think Tenzan's done it. Tenzan came close to doing it. I think he dropped one match. But yeah, it's just not doable, is it, anymore?
I mean, even if you had somebody who is universally beloved, more or less, you know, like even if you had, like if Nakamura were back in New Japan Pro or something, yeah. It would be bad storytelling with the climate of the way things are now, because they've had to work so hard to carve out these individual stars, you know, from all different perspectives. Like they've had to work hard to provide a sort of like something for everybody.
Yeah.
And you can't just completely crush everybody else at the expense of one person. It doesn't work like that anymore.
Yeah. It's
or at least it doesn't in New Japan Pro.
No. It's got to be realistic to everything, hasn't it? You know. It's also this is the time period where obviously Fujinami, you know, as we said, Chosu's 45, Fujinami's older than that, and he's starting to go down the card. He has a couple of tag team championships runs, like I said, he beats Hashimoto for the title in 93. When Hashimoto beat Fujinami for the championship back again, Fujinami had won it, he absolutely destroyed Fujinami, and it kind of like set the tone of the second generation's here. They're the guys who are going to take things forward. Our time is over, which is kind of sad in one sense, but it certainly put an exclamation point on what the three musketeers of Hashimoto, Chono, and Muta were going to be doing in the next couple of years. Fujinami did win the title back again from Kintsugi Sasaki in 1998, and he held it for over 4 months and then lost the title to Chono. So they didn't get rid of him entirely, but he was starting to feel the end of his career. But then again, 1998 is his last championship run, and he made his debut in 1968, I think, 1971. Mm. So, you know, this is a long time. This is 26 or 27 years at the top of the company, all the way through his career, who's either a junior heavyweight contender or a championship contender, all through those title reigns for 27 years. And that says an awful lot about his drawing power, his wrestling ability, and his storytelling ability. Meanwhile, Riki Chosu is also kind of getting to the end of his career as well. He won his he also tagged with Kintsugi Sasaki for another IWGP Tag Team Championship. And we do mention the Tag Team Championships a lot. I should mention that back in those days, there was no other championships in New Japan. There was the Singles Championship and the Tag Team Championship, and that was it. That's all they had. So,
which is unthinkable now.
Yeah. We was talking about this with Alex last week, that the amount of championships there was in All Japan Pro Wrestling. Yeah, the PWF and the United National and the International Heavyweight. And then there was the US title, and there was the tag team titles and the PWF tag team titles, and there was the PWF All Asian tag team titles. And it's like, whoa. Whereas in New Japan, there was a tag title and a singles title, and that was it. So if you were a tag team champion, you were instantly a contender for the World Heavyweight Championship because you were ranked very highly. So it was important that those tag team championship reigns were important, certainly showed a lot of belief in those wrestlers, again, late in their careers. But again, by the end of the 90s, they've really run out of options, and Chosu and Fujinami both end up in the back office booking for the company until 2006. When Fujinami gave the ultimatum of either it's me or him towards Riki Chosu, and New Japan stuck with Chosu. And I've always found that kind of a little... Here's Inoki, the guy that stood by everyone for 35 years and stood by the company for 35 years, and they picked Chosu over him, who'd left the company to make money for other people a couple of times by that point. I find it sticks in the throat a little bit. Wrestling's about making money and keeping a happy locker room, and if people thought Fujinami wasn't the guy to help lead the company, that's understandable. There is equally, why did it get that far for them to get that cross-purposed?
Yeah, it doesn't really seem fair.
No, it doesn't. Now, Fujinami went on to form Muga World Pro Wrestling, or Tradition, as in Dragon Tatsumi Fujinami, and Tradition. As opposed to tradition. Anywho, he started his own promotion, and they went on to reasonable success. And as Chelsea mentioned, he became a WWE Hall of Famer. Meanwhile, Riki Chosu, on the other hand, started his own promotion too, Fighting World of Japan Pro Wrestling, which was kind of a play on the 80s Ishin Gun company in 2003. And he worked with New Japan, and he created a legend stable with Masahiro Chono and Jushin Liger and Akira. And in 2005, he became a foreman booker and did a bit of wrestling for them. And funnily enough, since 2012, Riki has booked a series of matches for Legend, the pro wrestling company, and Tradition. So in the end, they ended up working together anyway. So it's really bizarre, this relationship that these two have. The two guys that kind of pushed pro wrestling forward, and in some cases, kind of like underratedly push pro wrestling for us, because Inoki and Baba are such big figures in pro wrestling, they don't necessarily get as much, what's the word, get as much kudos as they perhaps should do.
They don't get maybe the level of respect from the history books that they should.
Yeah, and that's interesting, kind of a little bit sad, really, in the sense of, you know, they did an awful lot of the hard work that laid the foundation for New Japan's business in the 1990s, and without them, you know, Strong Style doesn't really exist without them. You know, they're the ones that developed Strong Style, the two different paths of Strong Style, really. Chosu is the brawler, and Fujinami is the technician, but they're both genuine badasses as well. You know, these guys are the ones that can really, you know, put a match together that looks very realistic.
Two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. And, you know, their on-off relationship over the 40 or so years has really pushed Japanese pro wrestling forward. And they set up New Japan for the next generation, because if we go back to 1989 and Fujinami losing the IWGP Championship to a tournament that Vader won, that was the first time they went to the Tokyo Dome. And they filled it. And they would go on and fill it every year for the next 10 years. And a lot of that comes from what Riki Chosu and Tatsumi Fujinami meant to New Japan Pro Wrestling fans. And they were the big draws to start that period off, alongside Vader and alongside the emerging Shinya Hashimoto and Kieji Muto and Masa Chono. But they were the ones that drove all that forward. So let's have a quick word about style and things you'd like to pull out from Chosu and Fujinami. What do you think were the important things about those two wrestlers for you, Chelsea?
For Chosu, the thing that stands out to me most is the grappling. Like, it's just, it's always really, really intense, and he hits people very hard. which is such a shock when you're talking about strong style. For Fujinami, I mean, we were talking before about just how graceful he is. A lot of the technical moves that he has are not, they're not maybe as flashy as a lot of the way people practice them now, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still really incredible that when you watch it, you're like, how does that guy move like that? And even when you watch matches from later in his career, that really stands out. Just there's so much elegance there.
Yeah.
It's really incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. It is the smoothness of Fujinami is something that, you know, you don't really see in wrestling anymore because it's so more spot heavy now than it was. There are a couple of guys that, you know, have clearly watched Fujinami who are in, I would suggest Sanada, who's probably quite a Fujinami kind of fan.
Yeah, that makes sense. I could see that.
And certainly Okada is kind of in that kind of category as well. And you can see them being influenced by him. It was Chosu, Riki Chosu, I kind of see, like I said earlier, Tomohiro Ishii and those shorter guys. Makabe is probably another one who's highly influenced by Riki Chosu, in the sense of it's about power wrestling. They're not power wrestlers in the way the Steiners or Lex Luger were. They mixed some science with that, but that development of science and power at the same time is really important to evolving strong style and making it different and giving more facets to it, so it's not just the shoot style you expect, but trying to create something a little bit different. So there you go. I guess that kind of wraps us up on this particular subject today. Thank you very much for your time, Chelsea.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. You can follow her at Chelsea Comics on Twitter and at Shoulders_up. If you want to check out Shoulders Up, because some really cool stuff on there, written by Chelsea and Alex and our other friends at Shoulders Up. So go have a look at them. You can follow us on Twitter you follow me on Twitter at Sheriff Lone Star, and you can follow WrestleTalk at WrestleTalk_TV. Drop us a comment, send us a question, mention us, and we will respond. And, you know, also, can you review us on iTunes? We'd really like that, and on SoundCloud, and wherever you get your podcast from, where you can search WrestleTalk and find us. You can also listen to us on WrestlePlus, the wonderful streaming service from WrestleTalk TV, for $4.99 a month. You get loads of cool wrestling's content, documentaries, and new wrestling that you can find. So we hope you enjoy that. We hope you listen to enjoy the other podcasts on the WrestleTalk Podcast Network. We've got The Squash on Tuesday with me and Gavin, where we're looking at the 2016. Is it the year of the woman? I think it is.
I think after that Hell in a Cell match on Sunday, yeah, I think so.
Yes, I agree with you. So you can have a listen to that, and Chelsea, you can tell us if you agree with us next time you're on the show.
Okay, sounds good.
If you follow us on iTunes, like I said, please write a review. It does help with our algorithms. Listen to those shows, and we will see you next week. Bye.